This is Ed Helms, and I played Andy Bernard on The Office.
All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. This is The Office Deep Dive, and as always, I'm your host, Brian Baumgartner. And guess what? That was my mouth. Today is the day. Actually, today's actually the day for a few things. But first up, oh my gosh, I'm so excited to tell you that my new book that I know I've been talking about for weeks now is finally out. And how about that? Just in time for the holidays. Who could have guessed that? So head on over to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Books A Million, wherever it is that you get your books, and grab your very own copy of Welcome to Dunder Mifflin. And while you're at it, grab a copy for your mother, your sister, all your friends, anyone in your contacts list. You will not regret it. All right. Now, I also have another big announcement to tell you about at the end of this episode. So make sure you stay tuned after the interview and find out what in the world that could be. Trust me, it is good. And lastly, what you all came here for, my very special guest that is returning for part two of our conversation, the Nard Dog himself, Ed Helms. Now, if you haven't already, make sure you go and listen to part one, but then come right back here because I've been saving the best for last.
Yes, that's right.
The last. I'm starting to wrap up the interviews, which I know is very bittersweet, but the good news is over the next few weeks, you are going to hear a few of my very favorite episodes with some of my favorite guests, and you also may hear some of yourself. But that being said, today's interview truly is, it's one of my favorites because you get to see Ed in a different way, right? Ed is known for playing these kind of loud, bumbling, I mean, hilarious, but maybe slightly obnoxious characters, right? But Ed himself is just, he is so not that. I mean, he is hilarious and he's a comedy nerd. We talk about that. But today, what you're going to get to see is a very sweet, thoughtful side of Ed, because that's who he is. And I'm not going to lie, things get a little emotional. So here he is, the incomparable Mr. Ed Helms.
Bubble and squeak, I love it. Bubble and squeak, I know. Bubble and squeak, I cook it every morning, left over from the night before.
You said you were a comedy nerd. What was it about The Office when you started initially watching it that you felt like you were seeing something different? What was that?
Well, I don't know why. I wasn't able to sort of understand what I liked about it. But what I do think is kind of hilarious is that all of the awkwardness and the tension that we think is so funny, our parents' generation, especially as Southern parents, like, you know, repression is a very powerful force in Southern families. And that the awkwardness is so intolerable. And even on The Daily Show, especially with the field pieces, the correspondent field pieces, it was all about finding extremely tense moments.
Right.
And, you know, we would revel in the awkwardness and try to foster awkwardness with people because that tension is funny. And that's sort of my postmortem analysis. Like I never understood that at the time, and I couldn't understand why our parents' generation didn't think The Office was funny. Like, well, how do you not get this?
Right.
But I understand now that because I think I've seen more extreme versions of it that make me uncomfortable at times. And I can see like, oh, it's just a, it's like calibrating, like what's right here.
Right. Well, there's a number of fans who come up to me, huge fan. I'm the biggest fan of the show. I can't watch Scott's Tots. Like Scott's Tots.
Oh, wow.
Somehow yeah. puts it over the line. Dinner Party is sort of like the straddling, right. the straddling of yeah. the line. But Scott's Tots to people are like, no. And so I started to analyze like, well, why is that? And I think it's kind of what you were talking about The Daily Show, which was most of the cringy moments were happening to us, right? The office workers ourselves.
Right, right.
Whereas Scott's Tots suddenly was about these kids.
Yeah.
And that.
That's rough.
That's rough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fun to see. Like if your heroes are low status, the heroes of the show are low status, it's fun to see them squirm. But when you see like regular people squirm, and that's on The Daily Show, you know, we would try to make the bad guy squirm, right? Whoever the villain of a piece of a field piece was. But I don't know. Why is that funny? Why is squirming so funny? I mean, the most extreme versions were all of Sacha Cohen's stuff, right?
Sure.
The Borat and the Ali G.
Yep.
It's a powerful, it's an incredible mechanism for satire, but it can be polarizing for sure.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. Had you done much physical comedy before The Office? Like, did you feel like that was something that you did?
Well, I'd done a lot of improv, which okay. is obviously a lot of, you know, very broad physical stuff on stage. And I started by doing stand-up in New York City. And I actually knew John Krasinski from that. He started by going to New York and kind of dipping his toe in the stand-up world. But we were acquaintances back then. But that's just a funny side note. What was I saying before? Oh, physical comedy. So in my stand-up, I kind of fancied myself like a, I don't know, like a sort of Sandler-y or Brian Regan, like a perform, like someone who acted out my bits. And so there was a lot of physicality there. And then The Daily Show, I think part of what was fun about that was being a very stuffy reporter, but breaking that mold in ridiculous ways, sometimes physical. And so I don't know.
Right. Oh, did you really sing a cappella at Oberlin?
I did. There was a group called the Oberlin Obertones. There is, I should say, a group called the Oberlin Obertones. And I was in that group for one semester my freshman year. Or no, maybe it was spring of my freshman year and fall of my sophomore year. And then I didn't do it anymore.
Was that a joke that you pitched them
no.
about Andy? Or that was just coincidence?
That I think was something that, you know, there was a little bit of Harvard writers like using Cornell as a punching bag, right? That's a little bit of what was going on with Andy.
Right.
Greg being Harvard and Mike Schur and a couple others. But I had no baggage with Cornell, but I still just loved it seemed like a fun thing to make fun of. And so the a cappella character trait he was endowed with that in the writing process. But it is something that I understood implicitly. And I got a cappella is such an interesting art form because it is so fun to do, but it is kind of excruciating to watch.
Or listen to.
I mean, no disrespect to a cappella aficionados out there. I just, because my own relationship with it is complex. I have a love-hate thing. And I think, especially in college a cappella groups, there's a strong association with kind of a very clicky, smug, arrogant vibe, right? It's almost like certain preppy fraternities or something. And even though the Oberlin Obertones were actually not like that at all, there's really no part of Oberlin that's preppy. And
right.
It's something that made sense. And it really informed Andy in lots of ways. That the creation of Andy's profile was one of the most thrilling creative endeavors of my life because, you know, if it was the a cappella thing, I would just start singing on set at wrong times. And then the writers would see that and be like, oh, that's fun. And then they'd write in more singing. And that's just one example. There were so many little details that started to kind of slot in like a Tetris game about who Andy was. And it was this feedback loop. And Mike Schur in particular had a real shine for Andy. And we just had so much fun. Like, I would go up to the writer's room and just joke around with Mike about who Andy is and what made us laugh about him. Yeah, that was another thing that I think made The Office so special, is that the collaboration between the writers and the cast was next level, right? I mean, there were cast members that were writers to begin with, but then I always felt like the writer's room was an open door, and that when the writers were on set, it was always a conversation, like, what, like, how do we have more fun with this character, or what can we come up with? And everyone was open-minded, and that it's that kind of best idea wins mentality that leads to great stuff.
Yeah, I agree with you 1,000%. And Greg told me that he wanted that opened up as a workshop for the writers, actually, because he believed that the comedy in the show was so much about behavior, and you can't write behavior.
Wow, yeah.
And so—
Well, in the beginning, you can't.
Right.
Until you get to know a character.
Right.
But yeah, you're so right. There's a famous episode of Friends in which they start making fun of the way that Chandler talks, like the cadence of his speech. And it's a favorite episode. It's extremely funny, but it's something that could not have been written in season one. It's something that everyone started to understand implicitly, and it took a writer being like, that's funny. Like, that's a really specific funny thing about Chandler. And if the other characters clock it, we can write to it. But that's really cool to hear. I didn't know that, but you're so right. I mean, for Greg to be ahead of that, writing always gets better on a TV show as the writers learn the behavior of characters. But to start with that ethos of like, we are behavior forward, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Greg's awesome.
Greg is awesome. Changing gears a little bit, Mike Schur talked specifically about you during the writer's strike and coming out to the picket line that was happening, and what a difference that made for them as they were having a difficult emotional time picketing their own show. Do you recall anything about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I just remember everyone felt a lot of tension. Like, am I a part of this fight, or am I, you know, obviously I support the writers, it's scary a little bit. Like, it just felt so baffling. And I think in hindsight, I really appreciate how courageous that was. And yeah, there were a bunch of picket lines. I remember going to the first day was on our little lot up in Van Nuys, right?
Yeah.
It was just our writing staff.
Yes.
And
they said they were confused about where they should go. And there were things about going to Paramount or going to Universal.
Right.
And they thought, well, that's not where we work. This is where we work here. So they went on their own there.
Right. And then over the subsequent weeks, there were lots of demonstrations at the studios. I remember going to Universal Studios. There was a big one on the Avenue of the Stars. Like, they took over that whole block in Century City. The giant march. But that was a crazy, crazy time.
Yeah. I remember it was all very confusing, because ultimately the actors supported what the writers were doing, and the writers were, in a way, they were fighting the fight for all artists.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, I remember talking to my representation and going like, well, what, you know, and they said, well, you know, you have to show up. Like, you can't not show up.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the writers have talked about it was Steve not showing up. And apparently he got calls from the network executives and lawyers was told, you have to show up.
Show up to work.
To work.
Not to the picket line.
No, no, yeah, to show up to work.
Yeah.
And he just said, no. What are you going to do? Fire me?
How long? The strike was
100 days.
3 months? A little over 3 months? Yeah, since then, I've been in so many different parts of this industry now on different sides of things. And you know, unions are complicated, but they are so necessary. They are just the ultimate bulwark against exploitation. And not to get political here, but it just, like, being on the front lines of that and there were a handful of showrunners that really led the charge and took strong positions. And Greg was super inspirational through all that. Greg's a soft-spoken guy, but he is tough.
Yeah.
You know, like he's tough.
He fights for and stands by what he believes.
Mm-hmm. And in the case of the writer's strike, that was about principle and what was right or wrong. And yeah, it's good to be on Greg's side.
It's always good to be on Greg's side. Yes. Do you remember your impression when you heard Steve was leaving? I guess maybe more, were you afraid that the show couldn't survive? Or were you confident that it could go forward?
I think I felt pretty confident that the show could morph into a different thing. And I just had so much confidence in Greg and in the writing staff. And there had been, there were so many experiments that we all kind of went through narratively on the show that sometimes they worked and sometimes they didn't. And if they didn't, you just would kind of, it would veer away from that thing. And it seemed like there would be, like, if anybody can do it, it's the office writing staff.
Right.
You know? I mean, that's not to diminish the unimaginably massive blow that his departure is, was. But I think that the show felt bigger than any one person at that point, if that makes sense.
100%. Yeah. It is, though, a credit to you. I mean, much like Steve with 40-year-old Virgin, part of the way into your time on The Office, you became a giant movie star too with The Hangover. And I think you deserve a lot of credit for that, for not only staying around, but being energized and continue to work on your character and on the show with great integrity.
Thanks. That's very kind of you. I just love The Office. I kind of never wanted it to end. I think loving The Office really is about just loving the people and loving that cast and crew and it really feeling like a family and just wanting to step up and deliver for everybody's sake all the time. You know, shooting those movies was often exhausting because it was concurrent with The Office. I don't think a lot of people know or understand quite how crazy some of that was, but I was shooting cross-boarded episodes, meaning like I would do 2 days on The Office. I was shooting The Office Monday and Tuesday, and then The Hangover Wednesday through Sunday. It's insane. I mean, that was crazy. And then a lot of the Hangover stuff was nighttime, so I just was like a zombie. But it was so fun, and I never felt kind of judged or slighted by anyone. I felt fully supported. And I knew that if I slipped or didn't, wasn't there 100% for everybody else, then I had no right to be going off and doing these movies. I had to show up for The Office and still be fully present and 100%. And it helped that it's so fun. I mean, I keep going back to that. It was just, The only way I could do that was because The Hangover was fun, but The Office was fun. And The Office was the thing that I knew and I loved. And I knew I wanted to do right by The Office always.
Yeah. Did you feel like it was the right time to end after season 9?
I think so. I mean, at that point, I think my disposition had shifted a little bit. I was starting to look a bit the bigger picture of my life and career and my personal goals. And I think, you know, candidly, there were some ways that Andy, there were just some storylines there towards the end that confused me a little bit. And I just didn't feel like this is the same thing that I loved as much, if that makes sense. Not the show, but just sort of what, in particular, kind of some of what Andy was doing and or going through. And there was sort of a shift happening, I think, in my life and in my emotional state at the time. And so it actually felt like a reasonable place to wrap up, I think, in it. It's hard to remember how I felt, but
it's been a long time.
Yeah.
I am trying to unpack, like, why is The Office the most watched show in television now, 5 years later? Like, what are the reasons? And I think that there's a chance. Well, I recently went back and watched it.
The whole series?
The whole series.
Wow.
And it doesn't feel dated. And I started thinking, like, why? And the only answer that I can come up with is a documentary can never feel dated. Because it's taking a snapshot of what was actually happening.
Right.
You don't look at a documentary about the 70s and go, oh, well, that's dated.
Yeah, you're right.
You're just looking at that time.
You're right.
And
also the subject matter being an office that is not at the forefront of fashion or technology, all those things, you know, like a movie like Devil Wears Prada, which is so stylish and it's an amazing movie, but you'll feel when it was made because of all those cues. But you take a world like Dunder Mifflin, and those people and those props and those sets, like those are things that would not change in that space for 20 years, right?
Right.
Like it would look the same over a long period of time.
100%. Why do you think the show, we kind of talked about this, but why young people have responded so much to the show, given that it has to do with basically middle-aged office workers?
Yeah.
Like what?
Well, you know, we get asked this question all the time, any talk show, whatever. It's the most common, and or dinner party, wherever I am, I feel like people ask me this all the time. And I'm like, I don't know. Ask the kids. They're the ones who love it. We're left to just speculate, and I have lots of theories, I'm sure, like you do. I think the simplest version is the same reason that I loved Saturday Night Live when I was a kid, and I wanted to be on it. That was like the thing that drove my entire life, was wanting to be on Saturday Night Live as a young person. And the reason I loved it so much from such a young age, I started watching it when I was 8. And what was so intoxicating to me, even though I didn't even get the jokes half the time, they clearly were having so much fun. There was something, you could tell Eddie Murphy was in the zone, right? And I just loved that. And that was something that I sought my whole career and still do. And I think The Office is one of those rare places where a lot of the time that whole cast is in the zone, right? There's Even when the scenes are small and the performances are small and the dialogue is intimate or whatever, it felt so fun and special to be there and be a part of it. And at some level, that comes across, right? There's some way that I think audiences just clock that in the same way that I did as a little kid watching Saturday Night Live. And I think that's a huge part of it. I also think that there are some contextual things like it's a fishbowl, it's a bullpen, it's mundane, it's gettable, it's understandable. It's like, and the people in that office go through so many things, but you never question whether or not they're going to be there the next day. You never question whether or not they kind of love each other still. You know, there's something I think that makes people want to be a part of that Dunder Mifflin family when they watch it, because it's just comfortable. As awkward as the dialogue is and as much tension as there was at different times in the stories, there's a sense of belonging that everyone in that space had, and everyone had a role, and it was predictable, and characters' behavior was predictable and understandable. And I think that's takes a long time for a show to get there, and thank God The Office had that breathing room to find that. But when a show does, like Cheers or Taxi, you just love to hang out with it and be in that space.
Yeah. What are you most thankful for?
Oh, man. It's so abstract, but it's like, I don't know. The whole thing.
Yeah.
My last line that I said on the show, it really resonates, you know. It's like those were good old days for sure.
Yeah, it's crazy. I don't even remember how long ago it was now, but I saw you post a photo of me and you and John and Rain, I think at a Golden Globes. We're all like in our tuxes.
Mm-hmm.
And you put that quote. And it's hard to describe or put yourself back there, but it was just like, it's just one of those instantly, like, hits you in the chest in a way.
Yeah, there are just so few times in life when you just feel unburdened by a lot. And when there are so many times during the office that I just remember driving to work at 5 a.m. with a cup of coffee, so psyched.
Right.
And that feeling of just being psyched to go to work, being psyched to go to events with my castmates, to go hang out, get drinks with some writers, whatever. I just was psyched a lot during that whole time. And that's an elusive thing in life. You know, life's complicated and there are ups and downs. And most of the time we're kind of in the middle somewhere, and there's things we're psyched about, but there's things we're burdened by or scared of that are going on all the time. And at that time, I just remember being psyched a lot, you know, like a lot of the time, and hanging out at base camp in our trailers, just playing tunes with Creed.
I was about to say,
yeah. Or just like, hanging out with you, just talk, whatever gossip was going on, whatever, right. It's rare to feel like you're part of something special. And, but boy, is it awesome when you do have that feeling. And that's, I think, what defined that whole time for me. It just felt special.
Yeah. Well, Ed, thank you so much.
Oh my God.
For coming in and talking. And, I just appreciate so much. Obviously you and I have the longest history,
of anybody,
on the show. And I love you. And I so appreciate you coming in and talking about it for a little bit.
Oh man. It's awesome. You, yanked some heartstrings here that I wasn't expecting, but I'm grateful for it. I love it. And I love you too.
And that's Ed. That is Ed. And although on the day I didn't say to Ed that he yanked my heartstrings, he did. And he always does. I remember when I called Ed about sitting down with me, and Ed was working on another project at the time. He was incredibly busy, and he not only said yes, when would you like me to come in, but he said yes, when would you like me to come in, and then we started talking stories. At one point, I had to say, no, Ed, stop. No, wait, I don't have this. I'm not recording this right now. And I want to hear this spontaneously as you're remembering it. So I love talking to you, but I'm going to stop talking to you now because I want to talk to you when I have a camera or when I have a microphone in front of you. But his generosity, his heart, his spirit, well, I hope you saw it because it's true. So thank you, Ed, for joining me, and thank all of you for listening to me, and Ed. Thank you. And now for the second big announcement. All right. So as you know, I have been interviewing the cast and crew of The Office, my Office family, for the last couple of years now. And let me tell you, I never thought that I would be doing it this long. Right? My original intention was to do the oral history and write the book, and that's it. But sharing these interviews with you has been truly the greatest joy of my life. Letting you get to know these actors and writers and makeup artists and stand-ins and directors that have so much to give and so much to tell. Introducing you to the people who have inspired me, that for me is what it's all about. All right. So I keep getting questions like, Brian, when can you bring this guest on? Brian, when are you going to do this for other shows? Well, guess what, baby? We're coming back in 2022, and it is going to be bigger and better than ever. We're going to start at the top of 2022 with guest stars from The Office, people who are on just a few episodes, like the Will Ferrells and the Kathy Bateses. And then we're going to expand, and we're going to start talking about some of your other favorite shows. Think Modern Family, think Cheers, think Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, because those shows, well, they need love too. So stay with me here, same time, same place, same host, same feed, just more guests. And I promise you this, you're going to have a fantastic time, because when I have a good time, you have a good time. Now, as for the name, it's going to be called Off the Beat. And here's the story behind that. I had a French director that I worked with for many years, Dominique Sorand, shout out. And he taught me something, that comedy happens off the beat. And that's exactly the kind of conversation that I'm going to strive to have, one that happens off of the beat, about what happens off camera, in the moments between the stories,
because that's the kind of stuff that I want to know about. So starting next year, you're going to hear a new iteration of this podcast. Let's call it version 2.0, because that's what everybody names things, 2.0. It'll be everything you loved about The Office Deep Dive and so much more. But before the new year, I want to hear from all of you. All right, I'm going to be doing a couple of very special call-in episodes where you get to guide the conversation. That's right. I want to hear your stories. How has The Office changed your life? Is there anything that you have been dying to let me know? Do you have any spectacular or spectacularly funny stories tied in with the show or run-ins with the cast or anything? Really, sky's the limit. I just want to hear what you have to say. You know, when I'm out in public, I often have people come up to me and tell me very, very hilarious or moving stories about their experience with the show. This is your opportunity to share those stories, not just with me, but, well, with everyone. So the best way to be featured on one of our call-in episodes is to use the Voice Memo app on your phone. Record your question or comment and then email it to us at theofficedeepdive@gmail.com. That is theofficedeepdive@gmail.com. Make sure to include your name, where you're from, and then your question or comment. And don't forget to leave your number too, because yes, I am going to call a few of you back and have you on this show. All right. That's it. I've announced just about everything there is to announce. So with that, I will say goodbye. Thank you so much again for listening, and have a great one, everyone. The Office Deep Dive is hosted and executive produced by me, Brian Baumgartner, alongside our executive producer, Ling Lee. Our senior producer is Tessa Kramer. Our producers are Liz Hayes and Diego Tapia. My main man in the booth is Alec Moore. Our theme song, Bubble and Squeak, performed by my great friend Creed Bratton. And the episode was mixed by Seth Olansky.